Hello, crackheads. You're listening to Paranormal Cracktivity. My name's Justin.
My name is Dreke.
Welcome back to another episode. How are we feeling today, Dreke?
How are we feeling today? I'm feeling good. Feeling good.
Cool. I'm feeling good, too.
What did you do today?
I went for... Oh, well, today I was working at the adventure course. That's pretty much what I did all weekend. But this past week, I went on some pretty cool hikes on the Blue Ridge Parkway. I went to this place. It was really cool where there was like a plane crash that had been abandoned. And you can just kind of like walk right up to it and check it out. So
no one thought to clean up the wreck?
Apparently not. That's a good point. But I took some cool pictures. So maybe one day I'll find out what the story is and share that with y'all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Are you drinking anything tonight, Justin?
You know what? I should be drinking water, but I am drinking an IPA. Surprise.
Not really, but what kind of IPA is it?
Oh, this is a Gold Cliff Kona IPA. Kona is not sponsoring us. This is not an ad for Kona.
Is it at least good?
Yeah, it's good.
That's enough. That's all the answer I need.
All right. What are we getting into today?
Well, we are going to get into a real doozy. And it's something I didn't think I would ever cover. But things change, people change. Mm. And we're going to start with a little story. Baby Charlie had been suffering from a cold during the last weekend of February in 1932. On the night of Tuesday, March 1st, Charlie was still suffering from congestion, so his nurse Betty rubbed some medication on his chest to help clear the congestion. Between 7 and 7:30 p.m., Betty and his mother, Anne, put Charlie to bed and went on to do their household chores. Charlie's father, the colonel, came home a few minutes after 8 p.m. It is noted that baby Charlie was so sick that he went right to sleep when he was placed in his bassinet. After the baby went to sleep, the couple ate dinner, and Anne then retreated to her bedroom. While the colonel went to his office, which was directly below the nursery, he began to work for about an hour or so. A few minutes after 10 p.m. that night, Betty made her way up to the nursery. This was customary for Betty to visit the nursery around this time every night. She walked in only using the light from the hall. She felt a deep chill come from the room. She then made her way over to the crib because she could not hear the baby breathing. When she walked over to check on the baby, she found that the crib was empty. She didn't panic at first. She just assumed that Anne probably took the baby. She met Anne in the hall as she was leaving the bathroom. Betty then asked Anne if she had the baby. With a look of concern, she frantically said that she did not have the baby and that he was in his crib. Still not alarmed, they assumed that the colonel had the baby. Hastily making their way to the office, she asked him if she had the baby. He responded the same way Anne did, believing that the baby was in the crib. The three of them ran to the nursery. When they entered the room, the colonel searched for his boy, who was no longer in his bassinet. He ran to his room and grabbed his rifle from the closet. And on his way from grabbing his rifle, he said to Anne in a tremble, "They've stolen our baby." This is the case of the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh Jr., a.k.a. Little Lindy.
Oh my gosh. Oh no. That's so awful.
I know, this one is a doozy.
Yeah, this is going to be a doozy. It seems like a lot of assumptions were made. I'm just going to be straight up.
We'll get into it.
But I understand. I don't have a child. I can't judge, but
Before we get into the kidnapping, let's talk about Charlie's very famous father. Charles Lindbergh was born on February 4th, 1909 in Detroit, Michigan, to Carl and to Evangeline Lindbergh. His father was an immigrant from Sweden and was a U.S. congressman for Minnesota from 1907 to 1917. He was also well known for his book, Why Is Our Country at War?, in which he criticized the U.S. for its entry into World War I. Federal agents seized this book because of the Comstock Act. And I put a little note in here. The Comstock Act was an act that was passed in 1873 to suppress the circulation of obscene literature.
Oh, how about that?
And so I guess him talking about America's entry into the First World War was seen as obscene. I mean,
it seems like he was asking a valid question.
You know, I think a lot of people didn't ask questions during this time.
They weren't allowed to.
Yeah. But it's okay. It was later published after his death in 1934 under a new title called Your Country at War and What Happens to You After a War. Charles's mother was a high school chemistry teacher, and that's all I could really find. But I also found that he switched schools 18 times during his schooling, but he finally graduated on June 5th, 1918. While he was in his sophomore year of college, he dropped out to fulfill his dream of being an aviator. He then enrolled in Nebraska Aircraft Corporation's flying school in Lincoln, Nebraska, and began taking flying lessons. Where is Nebraska? I know it's like,
I don't know.
I know it's in like the United States, but like,
I feel like I'm going to embarrass myself. I want to say it's like north, almost like Midwest, north kind
of. Let's just say it's in the Midwest because I couldn't tell you any names of any of the states in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Anyway, Charles wasn't able to fly solo because he could not afford to. He then dropped out of school to start barnstorming. And barnstorming is a form of entertainment in which pilots do aerial tricks for paying crowds.
Oh.
And he also did wing walking. So he would like get out of the plane while the plane was moving and he would walk on the wings. And he did he parachuted from planes. So it seemed like he had like a need for like the adrenaline.
That's badass.
Because I'm not jumping out of a plane. No, sir. But I support you, Charles. To support himself, he did what he loved, which was flying aircrafts and being in the air. In October 1925, he became an air mail carrier for Robertson Aircraft Corporation. During that period in which he was flying mail and working as a flight instructor, he obtained financial backing from a group of St. Louis businessmen to compete for the $25,000 Ortiz Prize, which had been offered for the first nonstop flight between New York and Paris. Many people tried out for the Ortiz Prize. I think that's how it was pronounced, Ortiz Prize, and even a few died. But at 10:22 p.m. on Saturday, May 21st, 1927, Charles Lindbergh had become the first person to fly from New York to Paris. After this flight, he became an international celebrity and began talking worldwide about his experience on the flight.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
So right here is when we're going to start seeing some like interlocking connections. Because barely 2 months after Lindbergh arrived in Paris, G.P. Putnam's Sons published his 318-page autobiography, We, in 1927.
Mm.
Does that name sound familiar? Putnam?
It does sound familiar.
Do you know where it's from?
No.
Amelia Earhart's husband.
Oh, no way.
Yes, that G.P. Putnam. That exact G.P. Putnam. I think that's how Earhart met Putnam, is through his involvement with Lindbergh and the publication of his book.
Oh, that's so interesting. Wow. I knew I had heard that name and I couldn't remember where. Wow.
And they even called, I think I said this in the podcast, I mean, the episode about Amelia Earhart, they called her Lady mm-hmm. Lindy.
Oh, yeah.
GP, being about his book, he sold special autographed copies for $25. And to account for inflation, which is currently going up right now, those books would be $425.
Oh, each. My gosh. Oh, my gosh. Dreek. I was about to say, I'll take $25. Wow, that's crazy.
While on tour in Mexico City, Mexico, Lindy, which I'm probably going to call him Lindy for the rest of this episode because it's just much simpler than saying Charles Augustus Lindbergh Sr. Lindy met Anne Morrow, the daughter of Dwight Morrow, who was a partner at J.P. Morgan and Company. And they met because Dwight Morrow acted as financial advisor to Charles Lindbergh. Dwight Morrow was also a U.S. ambassador to Mexico in 1927, which was just a little fun thing that I found. On May 27th, 1929, the Morrow Estate in Inglewood, New Jersey, hosted the couple's wedding ceremony. And a few miles away from the Morrow Estate, Charles and Anne began to build their dream home, a home where they felt like they could get away from the public eye and raise a family and just have a quiet life. In June of the next year, Anne had given birth to Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. So sad, right? Because we know what happens to him. He gets kidnapped. So after they realized that Charlie had been kidnapped, they called the police around 10:30 that night. Harry Wolf, the police chief of Hopewell, New Jersey, and Constable Charles Williamson were the first on the scene that night. When they pulled up, Lindy was standing at the door with his rifle in hand. Major Charles Sheffield, I don't know how to say this name, Sheffield? Sure. We're gonna call him Major Charles S. Major Charles S. and fingerprint expert Frank Kelly arrived, and the five men made their way to the nursery. After looking in the empty crib, they noticed that the shutters were warped, which the family knew of because the home was had just been built. So there were a couple of things that weren't exactly perfect, and the family knew that the shutters to the baby's nursery were warped. And this made it impossible for the shutters to close completely. So technically the shutters were always open to the baby's nursery.
Oh.
They looked at the empty crib and then they saw that there were footprints on the windowsill. And they seen that mud tracks led to the baby's crib. This is when they discovered an envelope. After dusting for fingerprints, it was concluded that none had been left behind. The envelope was then opened, and Lindy was the first one to read the note. It reads as follows with a translation. It is me. I am translating. Dear sir, have $50,000 ready, $2,500 in 20 bills, $5,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making any public or for the police, the child is in good care. Indication for all letters are signature and three holes. You know what? I gave up trying to translate Because as you can see, the writing in this letter is horrible.
It sounds like the baby wrote it.
I think it's time for you to go to sleep.
Honestly, it sounds like the baby wrote it. The first thing that I thought when you said footsteps on the windowsill was Peter Pan. So it probably is time for me to go to sleep.
Oh, goodness. So at the bottom of the note, there were two interconnected blue circles surrounding a red circle with a hole punched through the red circle and two more holes on the left and right side of the outlying blue circles. This would serve as the kidnapper or the kidnapper's signature and will be used on other notes as the kidnapper or kidnappers would use to make contact with the Lindbergh family.
Okay.
With this baby missing, people are starting to be curious as to how someone could have snuck into the house without anyone noticing. Mm-hmm. No one heard anything out of the ordinary, and no one even heard baby Charlie cry. What was also out of the ordinary was the fact that they weren't even supposed to be there that night. However, with Lindy's office being right below the nursery, he did hear a loud thud. He assumed that it was just someone dropping something in the kitchen. He paid it no mind and he returned to work. The house was still in the process of being built and the Lindberghs were only there on weekends up until this point. This drew the question of how did the kidnapper or the kidnappers know that the family would be there that night if they were usually only there on the weekends?
Right.
We are now getting into the investigation. So, outside of the baby's second story window, about 75 feet from the house, was a makeshift ladder that consisted of three separate pieces. Upon examination of the makeshift ladder, they came to solidify pieces of information that would be crucial to the investigation. The kidnapper either knew how to make a ladder, or the kidnapper knew someone with carpentry skills. Of the three pieces that were there, the kidnapper, or kidnappers, I'm just going to say kidnapper, because it's a lot to say kidnappers and kidnapper. Mm-hmm. The unidentified could have only used two of the three pieces, because if all three were used, then the ladder would have been too high and would reach past Charlie's window. They also figured that the person who wrote the ransom letter was not from America. They took the ladder of the information from the structure, vernacular, and the spelling on the ransom note. Investigators also theorized that the unidentified wore gloves because the only fingerprints that were found were those of baby Charlie's. They also theorized that whoever took Charlie that night had worn burlap or socks over their shoes, because outside of the house, they could see the impressions of the shoes in the mud, but those impressions lacked shoe prints.
Oh, interesting.
They also found tracks leading away from the house, and then all of a sudden, the tracks stopped. They then brought out bloodhounds to see if they could trace a scent. The dogs picked up on the scent, but it stopped right where the tracks stopped, which meant that the kidnapper, or the unidentified, got into a vehicle after leaving the Lindbergh residence. Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf of the New Jersey State Police was officially in charge of the investigation. But Schwarzkopf, the father of 1991 Gulf War leader, U.S. General H. Norman Schwarzkopf.
Oh. Interesting.
That's where your dad comes in.
Right, yeah. I wonder, yeah, that's interesting.
Is that the war?
You said say it again.
The Gulf War.
The Gulf War? I'm pretty sure yes.
I'm looking it up.
I'm pretty sure yes. Because, like, yes.
That's the one your dad was in?
Yes. I'm positive, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Justin's dad, for keeping us safe.
Yes. Shout out to my dad.
So, Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf was the father of the general, H. Norman Schwarzkopf, who was the leader of the U.S. for the Gulf War.
The leader for the...
Did that make sense?
Okay, I got you now. Yes, I'm sure that that's... Yeah, he was in the Gulf War and the leader for the Gulf War. I see what you mean now. Yes.
So Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf gave major responsibility for the investigation to Colonel Charles Lindbergh.
Okay.
But running a kidnapping investigation was not a job for an amateur. Mm-hmm. Lindbergh's home had become the head of the operation. However, with inexperience in kidnapping cases, Lindy inadvertently allowed for major errors in the investigation into his son's kidnapping.
Hmm.
By March 2nd, hundreds of people came to the Lindbergh residence to get a first-hand glimpse of what was happening in the Lindbergh household. These large sums of people would later destroy evidence that was at the Lindbergh residence. This would not have happened if Schwarzkopf was in charge, because believe it or not, Lindy did not know what he was doing.
Oh, surprise. I feel like maybe he could have been blinded by emotion also. I mean, I'm sure that it was...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure that it was difficult to, like, I mean, stop a father from being involved, especially, like, someone who's so powerful. But when you're
absolutely
in such an emotional state, it's not the best time to be making decisions.
It is really not. But he was at this point the richest man in the world. I mean, not the richest man in the world. He was the most famous man in the world.
Hmm.
And so I feel like it would have... I don't know. People didn't have their brains right in the 30s. I'm just saying.
You're right about that.
New Jersey officials announced a $25,000 reward for the safe return of Charlie. The Lindbergh family offered an additional $50,000 reward on the top of that. At this time, the total reward of $75,000, which is approximately equivalent to $1,235,000, would change the lives of anyone that could bring home Charlie. Because at this time, you guessed it, we were in the midst of the Great Depression.
Wow.
So by this time, Anne had made a public plea with the unidentified and told them that baby Charlie had a cold and that he needed a special diet to help him get over his cold.
Aww.
On March 6th, a new ransom letter arrived by mail to the Lindbergh home. We're still in 1932. I'll let you know when we change years.
Okay.
The letter was postmarked March 4th in Brooklyn, carrying the same red and blue marks.
Hmm.
The ransom had been raised to $70,000 from the original $50,000. The reason for the raise was that the unidentified were not happy about all the public attention the case was getting. And a section of the letter reads as follows. I'm going to try my darndest. I'm just letting y'all know now. And ransom was made out for $50,000. But now we have to take another person to it and probably have to keep the baby for a longer time as we expected. So the amount will be $70,000.
Okay.
What I'm getting from this is that since the whole world knows they're going to have to keep the baby for longer until it dies down, and they have to hire another person to come in on this, so they're asking for an extra $20,000 to keep the baby alive.
Okay. Okay. It makes sense, but it doesn't make any sense. Like that.
You know, there's a lot of things in this case that don't make sense.
Yeah, for real. Mm.
The letter also stated that the baby was being taken care of, and they were following the instructions that Anne had gave them about following the child's diet for the cold. The misspellings in the second letter matched the dialect and the vernacular of the first letter, so they knew that it was written by the same person. Because you have the misspellings, the grammar is awful. Again, it looks like The baby wrote it.
Right.
A third ransom note, postmarked from Brooklyn, and also including the secret signature, arrived in the mail again. The note told the Lindberghs that a man by the name of John Condon should be the intermediary between the Lindberghs and the unidentified, and requested notification in a newspaper that the third note had been received. Instructions specified the size of the box the money should come in, and warned the family not to contact the police. So let's talk about John Condon and how he got involved with Charles Lindbergh's missing child. So John was a 72-year-old retired school teacher and principal, and he had put an ad in the paper with the hopes of drawing out the kidnapper or the kidnappers. Condon had written a letter to the Bronx Home News on March 8th, offering to act as an intermediary between Lindbergh and the unidentified. The day after his letter was published, someone purporting to be the unidentified contacted him. Condon, operating under the alias Jaffsy, was allowed by Lindbergh to try to contact the unidentified. And he got the alias Jaffsy from his initials, which were JFC.
Okay, JFC. Okay, I got you.
And so JFC became Jaffsy.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he got his alias, which, I mean, that was really cool.
Yeah, that makes
you
sense.
You go, boy.
Yeah.
John's letter reads as follows. I offer all I can scrape together so a loving mother may again have her child, and Colonel Lindbergh may know that the American people are grateful for the honor bestowed upon him by his pluck and darling. Let the kidnappers know that no testimony of mine or information coming from me will be used against them. I offer $1,000, which I have saved from my salary as additional to be suggested ransom. To the suggested ransom of $50,000, which is said to have been demanded by Colonel Lindbergh. I stand ready at my own expense to go anywhere alone to give the kidnapper the extra money, and promise never to utter his name to any person. If this is not agreeable, then I ask the kidnappers to go to any Catholic priest and return the child unharmed, with the knowledge that any priest must hold inviolate any statement which may be made by the kidnappers.
Okay.
I'm going to just say, I wouldn't have done it. I love you, Charles Lindbergh, but, like, I'm not putting myself in danger like that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm a little confused.
So he's willingly...
Can you summarize that again for me?
He's basically saying, I'm willing to do anything to get the child back. And if you don't feel comfortable giving the child to me, give it to a Catholic priest, because a Catholic priest can't tell.
Okay. I'm just... There's just a lot of really interesting interactions going on. Okay.
He's coming out of the blue, literally out of the blue, and just offering to be the intermediary between the Lindbergh family and the kidnappers.
Okay.
Like, he's never met Charles Lindbergh, doesn't know him from an aunt, but he is the most famous man in the world at the time. And so I guess he feels like he has some duty to the nation to do all he can to help find the baby.
I mean, if he's offering that big reward, I'm assuming that anybody would want to try to get involved that could, right?
But he's, John Condon isn't asking for any money. That's the thing. He's not asking for anything.
Oh, right. Right. You said that. Oh, yeah. So what is happening?
He's offering his own money so that the baby can get back to Anne.
They have enough money to pay the ransom. I'm so confused about what's going on.
He literally just inserted himself into this situation.
How ridiculous. Okay.
This is all that's happening. He just inserted himself. He put an ad in the newspaper and was like, I will literally be the intermediary between the family and the kidnapper. And the kidnapper was like, I choose you.
Okay.
Then Lindbergh was like, I choose you too. So that's how he became the, that's literally how he became involved in the case.
Wow. Okay.
Not a police officer, literally just a citizen.
Okay. Okay.
With an extra $1,000 to spare.
Okay. I'm really interested to see how this is going to pan out. I have a feeling I'm not going to be satisfied.
After getting this approval, John began to follow the orders of the unidentified and placed an ad in the newspaper that said, money is ready, Jaffsy. John and the kidnappers wrote back and agreed to meet in a cemetery with only John present. John and a man who said he was the representative for the kidnapping group only talked that night. The kidnapper, who is nicknamed Graveyard John, said that he was a Scandinavian sailor and he was working with three other men and two other women. He told John that baby Charlie was safe and that he was on a boat being taken care of. John Condon expressed that he was skeptical about the well-being of the child. The kidnapper assured him that the baby was safe and that he would send proof of the well-being of the child. The meeting ended without the return of Charlie and without the exchange of the ransom.
Okay.
After meeting with the Graveyard John, the Lindberghs received another piece of evidence of their son's whereabouts. On March 16th, the Lindberghs received the sleeping suit that Charlie was wearing the night he was taken.
Oh no.
Charles specifically noticed that it had been washed. After the Lindberghs identified the sleeping suit, Condon placed a new ad in the home news saying, money is ready. No cops, no Secret Service. I come alone like last time. So some more notes had been exchanged, and the 11th ransom note was delivered to Condon on April 2nd, 1932, by an unidentified taxi driver who said he received it from an unknown man. Dr. Condon found the 12th ransom note under a stone in front of a greenhouse at 3225 East Tremont Avenue, Bronx, New York, as was instructed in the 11th note. So, on the night of April 2nd, John and Lindy made their way back to the graveyard and delivered the ransom to the kidnapper in a custom wooden box, a box that was 14 by 6 by 7. This wooden box would be used to be so that way the ransom could be easily identified if it were to have been found in this specifically crafted box. The ransom money also had a number of gold certificates within it. After John handed over the money, he told Graveyard John that they could only come up with $50,000 instead of $70,000. Graveyard John's response was, quote, that's fine, end quote. Officers used gold certificates because they were about to fall from circulation, and officials thought that this would prompt the kidnapper to use them faster. The serial numbers on all the bills were written down and given to all the banks in America. After receiving the money, Graveyard John handed Condon a note. The note said, the boy is on the Bode Nelly. It is a small Bode, 25 feet long. Two persons are on the Bode. They are innocent. You will find the Bode between Horseneck Beach and Gayhead near Elizabeth Island. Now, I said Bode like three times. He meant boat.
Oh, okay.
But he spelled it B-O-A-D.
Uh-huh.
And if you know anything about a specific European language, You know that sometimes D at the end of words are pronounced as T.
Right, right.
Yes. So after this meeting, Condon was able to give the police enough information for a sketch for the perpetrator or the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
As for Charlie, they did not find a boat named Nelly, or they did not find Charlie. In the afternoon of May 12th, 1932, a truck driver named Orville Wilson was driving with his assistant, William Allen, when they took a stop so William could relieve himself in the nearby woods. As William made his way into the woods, he was greeted with a stark and bleak discovery. He had come across the body of a toddler that had been partially buried.
Oh, gosh.
This body would later be identified as the body of Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr.
Oh.
Betty, the nurse, was able to identify the body based on the way his toes were curled and by the shirt he had on. It was a shirt that she had made for him. The body was badly decomposed, and there was evidence that animals had scavenged the baby's body because there were a few missing body parts. This was no longer a missing persons case. It was now a murder case.
Oh, that is so tragic.
It is so tragic.
What an awful, it is so tragic. What an awful scene. Oh.
Trigger alert. I mean, trigger warning. Trigger. I mean, it's too late for that. It's way too late for that.
Yeah.
Okay. After looking at the body, the coroner found that the baby had been deceased for 2 months. Ooh. And that there was a large fracture on one side of the head and a small hole on the other side.
Oh.
With the time of death being placed at around 2 months prior to the discovery, it was concluded that Charlie had died the night that he was taken. Many even theorized that he fell from the hands of the person or persons who took that took him as they were climbing down the makeshift ladder that was used to steal him.
Mm.
This was supported by the ladder that was found near the Lindbergh's house being cracked in one spot, and being that it was also a homemade ladder. They had no solid suspects at this point as to who could have committed what was known as the crime of the century. So investigators decided to begin with the people who were closest to the family. This included mainly staff, because who else would have known that the Lindberghs would have been there on that night that Charlie was taken when they had only been there on weekends prior to that night?
Right.
One of the first people questioned by police that had a relation to the family was Violet Sharp. Violet Sharp was a British servant that worked at the Morrow home and had gone to the Lindbergh house because of her relation to Anne Morrow Lindbergh. Violet had given contradictory information regarding her whereabouts on the night that the baby was taken. It is reported that she appeared nervous and suspicious when she was questioned. She died by suicide on June 10th, 1932, by ingesting silver polish that contained cyanide.
Oh.
She had only been questioned 3 times, and her alibi was later confirmed.
Oh.
John Condon was also questioned, but after a search of his home, he was quickly ruled out as well.
Okay.
What was more confusing is how a person who wrote in broken English was able to steal the most famous baby in the world at the time while he was in the house full of people and while his parents were there. Even though they had a sketch, they were at wit's end without any other clues. They could only hope that the kidnapper or the kidnappers would mess up and use the gold certificates given for ransom.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into how they find their suspect. The FBI had lent all of its resources to help find the person responsible for the murder. Handwriting specialists examined the ransom notes and concluded that the writer of the letter was of German nationality.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They also spoke with Condon and he gave them an example of the accent that the person who picked up the money used. Over a 2.5 year period, a number of the ransom bills were spent throughout New York City. Detectives realized that many of the bills were being spent along a specific route, a route that connected the Bronx with the east side of Manhattan.
Oh.
This included the German-Austrian neighborhood of Yorkville. On September 18th, 1934, a Manhattan bank teller noticed a gold certificate that had a matching serial number of the ransom. A New York license plate number, 4U1341NY, was penciled in the bill's margins, and this allowed it to be traced to a nearby gas station. The gas station manager had written down the license plate number on the bill because a customer paid with a gold certificate. And by this time in 1934, gold certificates had gone out of circulation, so he wrote down the number of the license plate in case the bank did not accept the gold certificate as payment.
Mm-hmm.
The license plate belonged to a sedan owned by Richard Hauptmann, an immigrant who had a criminal record from Germany. When Hauptmann was arrested, he was carrying a single $20 gold certificate that matched one of the serial numbers from the list of gold certificates from the ransom, and over $14,000 of the ransom money was found in his garage later that day.
Oh.
He said that he was holding the money for a friend named Isidore Fish, who died in March of 1934.
Oh, bullshit.
Hauptmann stated that he did not commit the crime and that he didn't even know the money was that of the ransom.
I don't know about that.
Okay, so let's debrief. What are you thinking?
Okay, so first of all, I have to assume that they live in a pretty big house, right? Maybe.
The Lindberghs?
Yeah. The Lindberghs.
It was big for the time.
So I mean, maybe if there was only three people in the house, they might not have heard the baby being taken.
But it was more than three people in the house.
Oh, there was more than three people in the house.
They had a full staff in the house.
Oh, okay.
Because the house wasn't even done being built at the time.
It's hard. It's definitely hard for me to take even like with all of the information that I have, it's really hard for me to know where I stand. Like, because there's just been so many weird things that have happened, you know? Like, obviously, I don't blame the family. It seems like, Jesus, like, so fucking tragic. But, like, I don't even know where to go from here, you know?
I just think it's a very tragic situation. And I think that there's more to it.
Mm.
There are too many holes.
For sure. You know? For sure. And I mean,
I don't know exactly what the holes are, but I just know there are too many holes.
Yeah.
It's just, there's water's not staying in it.
Water's not staying. Yeah, that's a good point. And part of that reason, like you said at the beginning, is that a lot of the evidence was tampered with from the very beginning. It doesn't seem like it had a very strong start.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why. I think I can contribute the mass attention and the mass fluctuation towards the house and the ruining of evidence at the house.
Mm-hmm.
Contributes to why there are so many holes. Because up until this point, no one knew whether it was a kidnapper or kidnappers, if it was one person, if it were three people.
Right. That's another thing. I think they are being kind of smart in some respects. Like, for example, I mean, building your own ladder, then there's not a trail for where you bought the ladder, you know?
Yes.
Like, they have done certain things where I'm like, okay, they're really keeping us on our toes here.
And the whole, like, not leaving shoe prints.
Yeah, right.
This is a, I knew after that, and they didn't find any fingerprints, I knew that this was a criminal.
For sure.
Someone who had done crimes before.
For sure.
Someone who has either gotten caught and got released, or someone who has done these things preemptively and have never gotten caught for the crimes that they've committed because they took the same precautions that they did in the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And I also think that the police work on this was really good because if they didn't record all of the numbers of the serial numbers, they wouldn't have found the suspect.
Right. True.
This would have been a mystery till today.
And then paired with,
I promise you,
paired with the fact that they thought they were a German person, like, it kind of, yeah, like, that leads them straight to the right trail, I think. I hope.
And looking at the very first note that was written, let me find it. It just sounds like the misspellings is, you know, this person doesn't write in English. This English is not their first language.
Right.
They spelled ready, R-E-D-Y. They spelled money, M-O-N-Y. And they capitalized the M in money.
Oh, interesting.
And in the German language, a lot of German nouns are capitalized.
Right.
So that's just another indication that this was a German person.
Probably.
Or German people that were working together.
Probably not Peter Pan.
Probably not Peter Pan. Is Peter Pan German?
I don't know. It kind of, now that I say it, it kind of sounds like a German name.
Peter Pan. No, it's giving me very much Ireland.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's giving me very much sea shanty.
We know Peter Pan is actually from Neverland, so take that for what you will.
So, Hauptmann was indicted in New York on charges of extortion on September 26th, 1934. On October 8th, 1934, he was indicted for murder in New Jersey.
Oh, for this charge or for a different charge?
He got the extortion charge in New York, but he got the murder charge in New Jersey.
I'm sorry, I should have been more specific. For the Lindbergh baby or for somebody else?
For the Lindbergh baby.
Okay.
Extortion for taking the ransom and murder for killing Charlie.
Wow, okay.
The trial for Hauptmann began on January 3rd, 1935 in Flemington, New Jersey, and lasted 5 weeks. The case against him was based on circumstantial evidence.
Right.
I think that's the word.
Mm-hmm.
Tool marks on the ladder matched tools owned by Hauptmann.
Okay.
Wood in the ladder was found to match wood used as flooring in his attic. Dr. Condon's telephone number and address were found scrawled on the door frame inside of a closet in his home.
Oh.
The handwriting on the ransom notes matched samples of Hauptmann's handwriting. Hauptmann was also identified as the man to whom the ransom money was delivered. Lindy took the stand in the trial to give testimony of how that Hauptmann's voice was the voice he heard in the cemetery the night that he and Condon dropped off the ransom. Other witnesses testified that Hauptmann had spent some of the Lindbergh's gold certificates, and that he had been seen in the area of the estate on the day of the kidnapping, and that he had been absent from work on the day that the ransom payment was delivered, and he had quit his job 2 days later.
Oh.
Hauptmann never saw another job after he quit his job, but he was still able to live comfortably. He also bought a $400 radio and sent his wife on a trip to Germany.
Okay.
He also added that Isidore, they, I mean, the prosecution added that Isidore was so poor at the time of his death because he couldn't even afford to get treatment for what ultimately killed him, which was tuberculosis.
Oh.
So they're saying that Isidore didn't give you this money, like you're saying that he did, because he's dead, you're right, but he died of tuberculosis, which was something he could have, like, paid to get treatment for if he had this money.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So why would he give you this money and just literally just die?
Right.
When he could have paid for treatment with the money that you're saying that he gave to you.
Right. Could they treat tuberculosis back then? That was a stupid question. Forget I asked that.
You know what, Justin? I mean, I guess not for free, obviously.
Noted.
They're like, you don't have health insurance? We can't perform the surgery. You can't get these antibiotics. I'm so sorry.
Well, okay.
You're poor.
Well, I will say at first I was a little bit, I don't know. What's the word? I wasn't so sure.
Skeptical,
that's the word I was looking for. I was a little bit skeptical about why they had, like, taken him in so quickly, but that is a hell of a lot of circumstantial evidence, so I totally understand, like, him being convicted so quickly for that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I commend the police work on this.
Mm-hmm.
On February 13th, 1935, the jury returned with a verdict. Hauptmann was guilty of murder in the first degree.
Ooh.
The sentence, death. His defense appealed, but it was denied. Hauptmann refused a last-minute offer to commute his sentence from the death penalty to life without parole in exchange for a confession. He was electrocuted in the electric chair on April 3rd, 1936, at 8:47 p.m. And that is the devastating story of the kidnapping and murder of Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. He was only 20 months old.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. That was a good story, Dreek. Well, as good as it could be. Thank you for telling me that.
Very much a Debbie Downer. I have a few fun facts for you.
Oh, okay.
So fun fact, number one. Al Capone was in jail serving an 11-year sentence at the time, and he offered a $10,000 reward for anyone who had information that led to the safe return of Charlie.
Oh.
However, there was a catch. He said that he needed to be out of jail to help any further.
Of course. I feel like he had other ways to get out of jail, honestly.
He's Al Capone. Right. He knew he wasn't going to stay there for long.
Yeah.
Fact number two. After the kidnapping, Congress passed the Federal Kidnapping Act, commonly known as the Little Lindbergh Law, which made transporting a kidnapping victim across state lines a federal crime.
Oh.
Fact number three. Twice during the 1980s, Anna Hauptmann, the wife of Richard Hauptmann, sued the state of New Jersey for the unjust execution of her husband. Both times, the suits were dismissed.
Okay. I hate to say I agree with her, but I kind of agree with her.
Why?
Just because, I mean, like, as far as, like, the death penalty goes, if you're...
On the execution part?
Yeah. It's just...
I can see that.
Yeah, I feel like they did, yeah. Just because all of the evidence was circumstantial... I think that life in prison might have...
He belonged in jail, definitely.
It's not... Yeah, he definitely belonged in jail. I agree with that. But it's not really my place to say, but I don't know.
I feel like when there's so much circumstantial evidence against a certain person, it's just as good as having... hardcore evidence. My thing is that if there are so many pieces to the puzzle that you can see the picture and you can know what the picture is, but there are just a few missing pieces, there's really nothing you can do. Even though you haven't finished the picture, you can know, you know what the picture is, even if you don't have all the pieces.
Yeah.
And I feel like this was the case in this case.
I don't know.
He was definitely guilty.
Are you sure? They didn't have
any hard evidence. There's no doubt in my mind that he was guilty.
Okay. I feel like I have to be a devil's advocate. I mean, it's like maybe 85% of me thinks that he was guilty, but the rest is like, what if somebody set him up? We already said they were smart. Like, but then again, he didn't leave any evidence at the scene. So if it was him, like, how is, there's no way to tell. So like, for better or for worse,
well, he already had a criminal record in Germany.
Right. And that's definitely against him in that respect. So I don't know. I definitely think he should have been in jail. I just don't know if he should have been killed so quickly or put to death so quickly.
Yeah, I don't think he should have been executed. I don't think he should have been executed because of the fact that it was all circumstantial evidence. But he definitely did it, and he definitely belonged in jail.
Okay.
They just didn't have that thing that solidified his being in a jail, except for all the circumstantial evidence.
Okay, I believe you.
Which made a strong enough case. I believe you too. And also, in 1936, the year that Hauptmann was executed, that was the year that King Edward VII of England abdicated the throne to marry an American divorcee.
Oh, how interesting.
So that was Queen Elizabeth's uncle.
Oh, wow.
Because after King Edward VII abdicated the throne went to his brother because he didn't have any children. And his brother was Queen Elizabeth's father. And after Queen Elizabeth's father passed away, she became queen. So if King Edward would have never decided to marry that American divorcee, Queen Elizabeth would have never been the Queen of England.
Oh, interesting. Gotta love the monarchy.
I find it very interesting. I hate that I like it.
I don't know anything about it, so honestly.
And then, also in 1936, Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals at the Summer Olympics in Berlin.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's
Black History Month.
Yes. Those were some cool, fun facts.
Well, what's left of it?
It's always Black History Month.
I like you.
I really enjoyed that story. I have to say, I've heard this before, and I didn't remember pretty much any of it except for like the most important parts, which I pretty much forgot until you got to them. But the way that you told the story, it was, I don't know, it's made me think about things differently. So, yeah. And I'm still processing.
Yeah, I'm processing too. Do you think that Hauptmann had help?
Yes, because where's the rest of the money?
He spent it.
Oh, also because the footprints disappeared. Somebody picked him up.
Yeah. That's a good point. Do you think it was Isidore that was helping him? And that he was just trying to put Isidore down since Isidore had died? But
I know, I think that
he had the money.
Yeah, I think that was just like convenient. I think he was like, yeah, my friend's dead, and so they're not going to be able to follow up on this alibi, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you.
But that makes me, you know, that makes me even more strongly believe that he was guilty, because if you have the audacity to like give an alibi of a dead person, then you probably did it.
And also, he literally had the chance last minute to give a confession to stay away from the electric chair, but he didn't take that option, which kind of like makes me think, did he really not do it? Oh. Or did he do it and he just wanted to die for it? He knew that he wanted to die for it.
Oh, you're so right. You're very right. See, I'm really torn. It's really hard for me to have an opinion about this. I just know that it, I mean, whoever did it is obviously a fucking monster.
I mean, I do think I think he was definitely either the person who took Charlie, or he knows the person who took Charlie and he helped that person take Charlie.
Okay. Yeah, I can definitely agree
Either
with you on
way,
that.
he was involved from the beginning with taking Charlie. He was definitely involved, 100%. Not a doubt in my mind. I've never been, I don't know I've done a lot of research on this case. That's one thing I'm certain about is that he was involved.
I think I can
That's
definitely,
too
yeah.
much circumstantial evidence.
I can agree with you on that for sure.
But I really do think it was more than one person. I think, because there's no way that he was able to put the ladder together, climb the ladder, get Charlie, get in a car, and just drive
And
off.
I still want to know how they kept him quiet. That's another thing that baffles me, unless like, well, I don't even want to think. I don't even want to think about that, honestly. But
I think they kept the way, I think they didn't hear Charlie cry because the thud that Colonel Lindbergh heard in his office was the thud of his son hitting the floor,
oh
hitting the ground outside.
no, or the
And that's why he had
ladder.
the and that's
Oh
and
no.
that's why he had the fracture.
You're probably right. Dang, that's just so
I
sad.
thought you were gonna make that connection.
No, I'm not with it today, you know. Oh, wow. Yeah, you're probably right.
And I want to know how that hole got in the side of his head.
Well,
Here's my theory.
that's what I thought
My
about the
theory
ladder, but yeah, go.
is that Charlie fell as he was being taken out of the window. And Charlie didn't cry because I felt like Charlie had died at that point, had passed away at that point after being dropping two stories, being a 20-month-old baby. And then to make sure that Charlie was deceased,
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
he just made sure that Charlie wasn't alive
Which is interesting because,
after the fall. That's my theory.
yeah. I don't, yeah. I still don't know what to believe. Oh, when I heard like hole, I wasn't 100% sure what they meant. Like they didn't specify, right? So I was kind of thinking, oh, like he made his own ladder. What if there was a nail loose and he's like slipped and hit his head on the ladder? And like, I don't know. There's just a lot of different possibilities.
No one knows what happened that night except for the person that went into the room, left the ransom note, and took Charlie. And it was premeditated because the ransom note had already been written.
Right. Oh, so
Definitely
interesting.
premeditated.
It's a real head scratcher.
No shoe prints, no fingerprints. And everyone was in the house. Everyone was in the house. And it just so happened that the shutters on the baby's nursery did not close. They would have heard the shutters being opened if the shutters were able to be closed properly, I think.
Oh, I see. I was wondering why that was. I mean, like, I know that people could look in, but I was kind of thinking maybe that was not a big deal. But I see that. Yeah.
Because if you close the shutters, you can't open the window. R.I.P. Charlie.
R.I.P. Charlie.
R.I.P. Charlie. This one is a downer. I don't have anything to lift you up.
That's okay. You gave me the fun facts. The fun facts were fun. I have a fun fact. No, I don't have a fun
Yes. You sure?
fact. Well, I took an edible, so I'm hoping that's gonna kick in a little while.
I love that for you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Do we have any business to take care of, Justin?
Don't smoke crack.
Please don't. It's not cute. It's not cool. Crack is whack. Crack is cheap.
The crack is whack. Crack is cheap. Don't do it. Don't ever do it.
Do you know what my reference was there?
Almost. No.
I'm gonna keep on doing it until you figure out what my
Oh,
reference is.
I'm okay. Okay.
So I have to remember for every episode, crack is whack, crack is cheap. I make too much money to ever do crack.
Okay.
Find us on Instagram at Paranormal Cracktivity Podcast.
Yeah, do that. Email us at paranormalcracktivitypodcast@gmail.com.
What is our also other social media? Do we have any other social media?
Do we? I don't know.
Patreon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's that one.
We have stickers.
We have stickers. Join the Patreon now to get a sticker. Link
and in
the
description. And if you even want to,
description.
We'll get you a t-shirt. Just sign up, please.
Yeah, it's going to be a plain white t-shirt from Target that me and Drake are both going to sign.
I'll wear it if you want to. If you want me to.
Join our OnlyFans and just... at... And with that...
Don't do crack.
Don't smoke crack.
Crack is whack, crack is cheap.